Headlines: 25 Palestinians have lost their lives in the course of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza since Tuesday. Palestinians have responded by firing a barrage of rockets at Israeli targets. In Pakistan, the apex court announces the invalidity of Imran Khan's arrest. The former premier has been in custody since Tuesday. Also coming up, Iran's economy minister is in Saudi Arabia. This is the first such visit by an Iranian official since a recent rapprochement between the two countries. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Islamic Jihad says another of its commanders was killed in a new Israeli airstrike on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Resistance Movement confirmed the death of Ahmed Abu Dhaka. Meanwhile, hundreds of Palestinians participated in the funeral of three other Islamic Jihad commanders killed in Israeli bombing before dawn Thursday. The head of Islamic Jihad's rocket launching unit, Ali Ghali, and two other commanders died in similar airstrikes on Khan Yunis. Israel targets civilian buildings in Rafah, Khan Yunis, and other parts of the blockaded strip. Palestinian resistance fighters have kept up retaliatory strikes. They have fired barrages of rocket toward the occupied territories, including Ashkelon. It is now the third day of Israel's aggression against the besieged Palestinian territory. Over two dozen Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed. The correspondent in Gaza City, Ola Alassi, says Palestinians are calling on the international community to help end the Israeli atrocities.
Actually, Palestinians are angry over the international community silence over the Israeli crime, as the Israeli occupation commits crimes with impunity, supported by the other international communities and countries. The Palestinians are calling for an immediate international support and international the international community to take a step against the Israeli occupation, to try to stop the atrocities and the crimes happening and the Israeli attacks happening, taking place in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians also are condemning the silence of the community, as it is always known that the community, the international community, is always silent against the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people. But when it comes to any atrocities or crimes, war crimes in other countries, it takes immediate steps to try to hold the responsible, to hold fully responsible for the people who commit these crimes. But when it comes to the Israeli occupation, it never been held accountable for its crimes.
A young Palestinian man has succumbed to the wounds that he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank. According to Palestinian medical sources, Als Amin Hamamdeh was wounded when the regime forces stormed the town of Kabatiya, south of Jenin. The town has witnessed repeated Israeli assaults. On Wednesday, troops raided the town again and opened fire on locals, including on a vehicle that left two Palestinians dead and another wounded. They also broke into homes and destroyed the people's property. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year. May 11 marks the first anniversary of the Israeli killing of renowned Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was fatally shot while covering the regime's violence against Palestinians in the occupied territories. In Iran, no one has been held accountable for the journalist's brutal murder.
Hundreds of people attended a memorial service for slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Akleh held an American passport and worked for the Al Jazeera TV network. She was killed by an Israeli sniper on May 11, 2022, while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Nobody guessed she would be lying on the ground lifeless just hours later. Footage captured moments after she was shot shows her motionless body with another Palestinian reporter being seen next to her. Both are wearing easily recognizable press vests and blue helmets. Since her killing, Abu Akleh has been hugely remembered by Palestinians for her dynamism and courage to cover Israeli crimes. The road where her office was located is now named Shireen Abu Akleh Street.
Every morning we pass by her office to say good morning, Shireen. All our colleagues, including myself, who accompanied her when she was martyred, still think that she is on vacation and will be back to the office.
Shortly after her death, the U.S. government said evidence showed Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli bullet. But ironically, Washington claimed that it had seen no evidence pointing to her killing being intentional, a line that has also been used by the Israeli regime. Washington also promised an investigation to find out the truth, but a year of U.S. inaction has prompted Palestinians to take the matter into their own hands.
The case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We're still working to pressure on the Attorney General and the court itself to act and to take a stand in this regard, either by announcing the creation of an official independent international investigation committee or by simply announcing his position.
Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli regime. A report by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate published in 2023 shows Israel has murdered more than 50 Palestinian journalists in the past 22 years, but the regime has never taken responsibility for any of those killings. Many fear that Israel's impunity only means more Palestinian journalists will be killed in the future.
Israel wants to silence the free speech and the voice of the press, as well as the truth which convey the atrociousness of the Israeli occupation and its crimes.
Even Western politicians who are staunch supporters of Israel are now calling for an independent and thorough probe into the Palestinian journalist's murder. But after so many calls and too many letdowns, many are now questioning whether the situation would have been different if Abu Akleh had not been Arab or Palestinian.
Pakistan's Supreme Court has declared invalid the arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan earlier this week. The court said the whole process of arrest needs to be backtracked. Khan has been in custody since Tuesday in connection with a corruption case. His arrest sparked nationwide civil disturbances. Violent clashes erupted between Khan's supporters and police in several cities. The government has already given its approval to the deployment of troops to Punjab and Islamabad to restore peace. On Wednesday, the cricketer-turned-politician Khan was remanded in police custody for 8 days. On Thursday, authorities also detained Shah Mahmood Qureshi, close aide to Khan. In a statement, the Tehreek-e-Insaf party announced that Qureshi was taken to an undisclosed location.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery. The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law, as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury, but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Iran's economy minister is on a visit to Saudi Arabia, the first such trip by an Iranian official since the restoration of ties between the two countries. Ehsan Khanduzi is leading a high-ranking delegation in the port city of Jeddah. The minister is scheduled to meet with Saudi officials and address meetings with the Islamic Development Bank. Khanduzi said in April that Tehran aimed to raise its annual trade with Riyadh to $1 billion. Iran and Saudi Arabia signed a normalization agreement brokered by China in March, stipulated the reopening of embassies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign minister says Saudi Arabia has appointed an ambassador to Iran. The Iranian minister did not give the name of the ambassador. The 34th International Book Fair has opened in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Our correspondent Salman Kujuri says the event has brought together hundreds of publishers together.
We have over 2,700 Iranian publishers, plus 200 booksellers, and over 100 international publishers who are taking part in the 10-day event. So this provides a good opportunity for distributors, for book lovers, enthusiasts, and also retailers to get together, to do business, to exchange information and culture somehow. It provides a good opportunity also for kind of a cultural exchange among nations. As I said, we have many international publishers from over 40 countries taking part in the 10-day event, and this is seen and considered as one of the biggest book fairs in the region. And as you know, book conveys all culture and also the meanings and also the traditions of each country. So it's always been valued and highly revered by many people, especially in Iran, which has a long history and kind of a civilization rooted in book and culture. So people seize this opportunity to be among the first people to get themselves to the Tehran International Book Fair to get the latest update about what's new in the market, book market.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has urged Congress to raise the nation's debt ceiling to ward off an economic crisis. Janet Yellen called on legislators to increase the $31.4 trillion federal debt limit to avert an unprecedented default that would trigger a domestic as well as a global economic downturn. Her comments came after President Joe Biden warned that the country could slip into a recession if lawmakers fail to raise the debt ceiling. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. If the limit is not raised by June 1st deadline, the U.S. may default on its debt payments, which in turn could touch off a global economic catastrophe. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has doubled down on his claims about the 2020 presidential election in an exclusive interview with CNN. In a contentious 70-minute broadcast, Trump again refused to acknowledge that he lost to Joe Biden. He touted his false claims that the last election was rigged. He also declined to express regret over the Capitol attack when his supporters sought to prevent Congress for ratifying the election result. He repeated his plan to pardon individuals involved if voters return him to the White House in 2024. The CNN interview came one day after a federal jury found Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming a female columnist. The court ordered him to pay $5 million in damages to E. Jean Carroll. Following a quadrilateral meeting in Moscow, foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey have agreed to prepare a roadmap aimed to promote the relations between Damascus and Ankara. Marina Kortunova brings us more on that.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the UN. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the UN humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8% by the emergency appeal of the same UN to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Germany's railway union EVG announces a new strike as wage talks with a state train operator and dozens of other rail companies drag on without a resolution. The walkout is set to start on Sunday and end on Tuesday. It follows a nationwide strike by rail workers in April that paralyzed much of the network. The EVG, which is negotiating on behalf of 230,000 workers, is seeking a 12% wage increase or at least an additional 650 euros per month. The state train operator wants to keep it between 8 and 10%, but would phase in these increases over time. German railway strike comes as the latest in a wave of industrial actions in several European countries that are struggling with high inflation and a cost of living crisis. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
African Americans make up about 14% of America's population of 332 million. Almost a third of prisons across the United States are filled with African Americans. According to human rights activists, black people are the biggest systematic victims of police brutality in the United States. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. At the end of a historic two-week tour of the United States, a United Nations mission has concluded that the country must move beyond piecemeal reform and slogan-making and tackle the ongoing scourge of police brutality and law enforcement's discrimination against African Americans. United Nations experts completed their first official visit to the United States as part of a system of global inquiries set up by Human Rights Council after the police murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. As they ended their tour of the United States on Friday, 5th of May, in Washington, D.C., the United Nations experts called for a nationwide commitment to address discrimination suffered by black Americans in their daily dealings with law enforcement. Dr. Tracy Kissi, one of two independent UN experts who conducted the visit, said, "In the United States, racial inequity dates back to the very creation of this country, and there are no quick fixes." Dr. Tracy Kissi added, "To this day, racial discrimination permeates through encounters with law enforcement, from first contact, arrest, detention, sentencing, and disenfranchisement." Dr. Kissi said, "What was needed was a whole government approach," adding, "This needs to be more than a slogan and calls for reform." In the course of their 15-day mission, Dr. Tracy Kissi and Juan Menendez of Argentina visited six U.S. cities: Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Georgia, Los Angeles, California, Chicago, Illinois, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and New York. Their mission was to investigate excessive use of force, militarized policing, racial profiling, and other human rights violations by law enforcement and penal agencies against black Americans. As they crisscrossed the country, the United Nations experts had emotional encounters with families of the victims of police killings and brutality and other law enforcement abuses. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a white police officer murdered George Floyd on 25th of May 2020, the panel spent time with the mothers of Philando Castile and Amir Locke, who were also killed by law enforcement in Minneapolis. Presenting their preliminary findings, Dr. Tracy Kissi said they had witnessed a pattern that could be traced to what she called the deep intrinsic legacy of slavery and legalized discrimination. She said that across the country, there remained a lack of awareness and acknowledgement of the extent to which racial inequities were still prevalent in the United States. The United Nations experts said the result was a culminating exhaustion in the black community. Juan Mendez of Argentina, a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on torture, said he had been moved throughout the visit by the harrowing pain of victims and their families and the resounding calls for accountability. Juan Mendez said, "We support those calls for accountability." He was heartened by successful prosecutions of police officers involved in high-profile killings, such as those of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky. However, many more cases remained unresolved, suggesting a continuing degree of impunity. Juan Mendez added that their mission would be calling on U.S. Justice Department to make more serious and proactive use of its power through consent decrees to intervene in the inner workings of local police departments to address some of the most egregious abuses. Mendes said more robust government action is needed. The United Nations experts will present their final report to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland in September or October of this year. They indicated that among the demands they are likely to make is a call for better nationwide data and record and record-keeping. Juan Mendes said, in the absence of a national database, police officers who had complaints of misconduct or excessive use of force filed against them were allowed to continue serving, in some cases going on to be involved in killings of African Americans. He added, the mechanism also received allegations of police officers who were previously guilty and or disciplined for misconduct, afterwards being hired by a different police department. Among other likely demands signaled by the United Nations experts were, 1. A call for an end to racial profiling in policing in America. 2. A dramatic reduction in the use of solitary confinement in U.S. jails and prisons. And a total abolition of isolated incarceration for children under the age of 18. 3. Passage of George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which tackles racial bias and excessive use of force by law enforcement, but which has stalled in Congress. 4. An end to stereotyping of black women and girls as angry and aged up. 5. Rooting out of white supremacist law enforcement officers to ensure that they no longer wear a police badge. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Activists have urged California State to provide millions of dollars in compensation to black American citizens as a means of apologizing for slavery and past injustices, rejecting the State Reparations Task Force proposal as inadequate. The 9-member Reparations Task Force, established through the state laws endorsed by Governor Gavin Newsom of the Democratic Party in 2020, has spent over 12 months on research while hosting sessions to listen to the public across California. Their efforts have culminated in a comprehensive plan on how to address various instances of racist injustices through restitution. The panel was receiving final feedback from citizens on Saturday, 6th of May, while examining ultimate proposals to present to the California Assembly, which will subsequently determine whether to execute the actions and forward them to Gavin Newsom's office for endorsement. The latest proposal came out recently suggesting a total amount of $1.2 million per person based on the average life expectancy. The estimates include a loss of $2,352 for every individual annually who resides in California due to excessive policing in black communities, a loss of $3,366 per individual annually for biased lending and zoning, a loss of $13,619 per individual annually for unfairness and prejudice in healthcare, and a loss of $77,000 per individual due to the devaluation and loss of black-owned businesses. Meanwhile, activists present at the gathering dismissed the current plan as insufficient. San Francisco is considering its own compensation plans at the community level, which consists of a suggestion to distribute $5 million to eligible black inhabitants. The report did not specify the expenses incurred by the state, but according to economists' approximations in March, the overall expenses due to the negative effects of housing and mass imprisonment could exceed $800 billion. In addition to monetary considerations, the task force suggests a number of policy modifications to address racial bias, including an official apology from the California legislature and from the governor of California for past instances of slavery and anti-black racism. A nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California report revealed that in California, black families earn 60 cents for every dollar earned by white families. Nearly 6.5% of California residents, roughly 2.5 million people, identify as black or African American. Other cities across the United States have also moved forward with reparations proposals. Authorities in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, authorized $10 million in reparations as housing allowances in 2021. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors has also expressed support for reparations that could offer several million dollars.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
We are looking at the issue that what does it mean to be the Shia of Ali? And the way of answering that question is to look at the companions of Ali, because they are the ones who will be the examples and role models for us. And in that pursuit, we have looked at the example of Salman al-Farsi. Then we looked at the example of Abu Zar al-Ghifari. And in today's afternoon majlis, we looked at the example of a lady from the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen by the name of Sauda bin Ammar al-Hamdaniya. And tonight, inshallah, I'll be talking about briefly about Miqdad. But before I come to that, again, I would like to go back to the conceptual basis of my discussion, that Iman is not a static thing. It has different levels. And we have to constantly work hard to reach to the higher levels. As the sixth Imam said that, you know, Miqdad was on the eighth level, Abu Zar on the ninth, and Salman was on the tenth level. I also explain this example, this phenomenon, in relation to the amal. It's not only iman, even the quality of amal is influenced by the iman, and the iman is also influenced, it would even influence the iman. And so they interact with one another. In our discussion, it was important for me to point out again and again that when we look at the hadith about the ashab of Rasulullah, you should not be worried that, oh, where is Ali? As I said, you know, this question of if Salman is on the 10th level, where is Ali? It doesn't rise there. When you talk about the Ahlul Bayt, la yuqasu bihim ahadun, these are their words. Nobody is to be compared to them. Their standard is completely different. Remember the hadith from the sixth Imam last night, talking about the 12 months, four of them are considered to be sacred, Rajab, Zilqa'dah, Zilhijjah, and Muharram. An Imam asked this companion, when he asked this question about Abu Zar, that who, there is nobody more truthful than him on the earth. And that's where Imam said, what about month of Ramadan? It's not one of those 4 months. And then Imam said, remember Laylatul Qadr. That one Laylatul Qadr in Ramadan is more, you know, weighty, more important and significant than 1,000 months. So don't look at the Ahlul Bayt from that perspective. Yesterday when we talked about Abu Zar, there was a hadith where the Prophet says, Abu Dhar fi ummati shabih Isa ibn Maryam fi zuhdihi wa wara'ihi. That Abu Dhar in my ummah is similar to Isa ibn Maryam in his asceticism and his abstinence, his zuhd and taqwa. And this is again, you know, one side point I would like to mention. I didn't talk about it last night. Some of the modern, you know, days Muslim intellectuals, they have this habit of always looking at what is the trendy ideology, current ideology. And then they try to fit Islam in that, instead of looking at Islam by itself. You know, so there was a time in 60s, 70s, when socialism was the, you know, a trend, the fashion among the intellectuals. If you're a socialist, then you are, you know, yeah, he's there. And so some of these intellectuals, Muslim intellectuals in Pakistan, in Egypt, they started to say, okay, how do we relate that to Islam? And they came up with the example of Abu Dhar, because of his simple life, because of his struggle against the nepotism of Osman and the wrong, unjust distribution of Baitul Mal, they said, oh, Abu Dhar was a socialist. If Abu Dhar was a socialist, then even Isa would be the socialist, according to this hadith of Rasulullah. You know, this is not, Abu Dhar is not a socialist, he was a Muslim. You know, you look at the Islamic values. And so, when we look at the example of Abu Dhar being like Isa, alayhi salam, you know, some people might say, well, what about Ali then? And again, I would say the same thing. Don't compare Ahlul Bayt to the Sahaba. There's two different standards you're talking about. If you are worried that if Rasulullah has mentioned Abu Dhar as Shabih Isa ibn Maryam, similar to Isa ibn Maryam, then what is the position of Ali? If you're that much worried about it, I'll narrate to you a hadith of Rasulullah quoted by at least 25 Sunni muhaddiseen about Ali ibn Abi Talib, where the Prophet says, "Man arada an yanzura ila Adam fi ilmihi, wa ila Nuh fi taqwahi, wa ila Ibrahim fi ilmihi, wa ila Musa fi haybatihi, wa ila Isa fi ibadatihi." Whoever would like to look at Adam in his knowledge, Nuh in his piety, Ibrahim in his forbearance, Musa in his reverence, Isa in his ibadat and worship, فَلَيَنْظُرْ إِلَىٰ عَلِي بِنْ أَبِي طَالِبٍ. He should look at Ali. That was only one example there. You got worried. Oh, where is Ali? But this is where Ali is. All the good qualities, the most outstanding qualities of all the great prophets, if you want to see it gathered in one personality, that is Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. There is a narration in the Sunni books also, and this is from actually a Shia source from our sixth Imam. In the praise of Miqdad, where the Prophet once said, "Inna Allah amarani bi hubbi arba." Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded me to love four individuals. So there's Ashab was sitting there. Now everybody wants to know to see whether my name is included in those four or not. So they said, "Man hum ya Rasulullah?" And Rasulullah said, "Ali bin Abi Talib." And then he was silent. He said, "Four." He took the name of Ali and then he was silent. And then again he says, "Inna Allah amarani bi hubbi arba." Again silent. Again they said, "Ya Rasulullah." Rasulullah knows the psychology. He wanted to just increase their anxiety there to know who are these four people. He mentions Ali because they know Ali would be there anyway. But who are the other three names? He does this two times. And only third time when they say, "Waman hum ya Rasulullah," the Prophet says, "Ali bin Abi Talib, والمقداد بن أسود وعبو ذر الغفاري وسلمان الفارسي." And this is where we have to realize when we talk about those who are Shia of Ali during the lifetime of Rasulullah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Russia and China have enjoyed close relations militarily, economically, and politically, while supporting each other on various global issues. The two countries are on pace to hit $200 billion in turnover this year. Commentators have debated whether the bilateral strategic partnership constitutes an alliance. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Moscow Times reported Chinese Defense Minister Li Shangfu has recently hailed ties with Moscow during a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. He said in translated remarks broadcast on Russian TV, "We have very strong ties. They surpass the military-political alliances of the Cold War era. They are very stable." He added that Russia-China ties have already entered a new era. "This is my first overseas visit since taking over as China's defense minister. I specifically chose Russia for this in order to emphasize the special nature and strategic importance of our bilateral ties," Lee said. In the meeting also attended by Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin welcomed military cooperation between Russia and China. Putin said, "We are also working actively through the military departments, regularly exchange useful information, cooperate in the field of military technical cooperation, conduct joint exercises." He added, "This is undoubtedly another important area that strengthens the exclusively trusting strategic nature of our relations." Lee's trip to Russia, which will last until April 19th, comes weeks after an official visit to Moscow of China's leader Xi Jinping last month. During 2 days of talks, Putin and Xi hailed a new era in their relationship and discussed Beijing's proposals to end the conflict. Moscow and Beijing have, over the past years, ramped up cooperation, both driven by a desire to counterbalance U.S. global dominance. Their partnership has only grown closer. Since Russia-Ukraine conflict, China has sought to portray itself as a neutral party in the crisis in Eastern Europe, but Washington has accused Beijing of mulling arms exports to Moscow, claims that China has denied several times. According to RT, Beijing's trade with Moscow has continued to grow, with both exports and imports rising significantly in March in annual terms, Chinese customs data shows. According to a report published recently, Chinese exports to Russia soared by 136% year-on-year, while imports from the country jumped by 40.5%. Overall exports of Chinese cars, steel, clothing, and plastics to Russia and other countries rose strongly in March. Statistics also showed that Beijing's coal purchases from abroad more than doubled last month, hitting a three-year high. Oil imports increased by 22.5%, iron ore by 14.8%, and soybeans by 7.9%. China's trade with Russia hit a record high in 2022, growing by nearly a third amid Western sanctions against Moscow. Bilateral trade is on track to reach $200 billion this year, according to first quarter results published earlier this month. Official statistics show that Russia was the leader among China's 20 largest partners in terms of trade growth in 2022. China has been competing with India as Russia's biggest buyer of oil and has overtaken the EU as the top importer of Russian agricultural products. Beijing's seaborne imports of Russian oil have been hitting record highs as refiners take advantage of cheap prices amid a domestic fuel demand rebound following the lifting of COVID restrictions. Moscow and Beijing are actively working on the implementation of the Power of Siberia 2 energy project, which was among the issues discussed during President Xi Jinping's official visit to Russia recently. That's according to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, who spoke to Izvestia news agency recently about the proposed mega deal. He said the project has support. Companies have been instructed to work out the details of the project and sign it as soon as possible. It is envisaged that the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline will supply 50 billion cubic meters of gas each year, which Novak described as a volume that would completely replace the Nord Stream Energy Network. Russian President Vladimir Putin stated during his meeting with the Chinese leader recently that almost all parameters of the agreement on the new gas pipeline had been agreed. He also stressed that energy cooperation between the two countries has been growing, with Russia becoming a strategic supplier of oil, gas, coal, and electricity to China. The Power of Siberia 2 project involves the construction of a gas pipeline to China through the territory of Mongolia. China currently gets most of its Russian gas via the Power of Siberia pipeline, which has an annual capacity of 38 billion cubic meters. It is a section of the so-called Eastern Route, which was partially launched in December 2019, becoming the first pipeline to supply Russian gas to China. The Eastern Route includes the 3,000 kilometers long Power of Siberia pipeline in Russia and a section in China that extends to 5,111 kilometers. The mega pipeline is part of a $400 billion 30-year agreement between Russia's Gazprom and the China National Petroleum Corporation, which was inked in May 2014.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. There are some issues that are a problem due to a lack of agreement among high-level officials. So how do we solve these? The solution is for you to sit together, discuss things, make a unified decision, and take action. This is why a council has been formed. In any case, I hope that, God willing, as for what you want and what you are saying, I know that it is coming from your heart and that what you are saying is what you truly believe in. May God grant me the success of being able to carry out that which I am responsible for, and, inshallah, may the officials complete that which they are responsible for. The literature used in today's speeches was excellent. It was truly good and well thought out. I emphasize the issue of expressing matters using appropriate words. This has an impact. Well, the month of Ramadan is the springtime of spirituality and worship, and it is coming to an end. But God willing, you have many other months of Ramadan before you.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You young people have tens of months of Ramadan before you. You should take advantage of them. They are a springtime for spirituality, a springtime for worship. Youthhood is also a springtime. It is the springtime of life. Thus, a young person has an extra springtime in the month of Ramadan, a spring within a spring. Take advantage of this. There is a big difference between what you can gain from the Qadr night compared to what someone at my age can gain. You can benefit much more from it. Treasure it. This beautiful coupling, that is a coming together of two springs, was seen somewhere else as well, during the sacred defense, when the two opportunities of exaltation and ascension existed alongside each other. Well, being present in the front of defense means being in a front where you give your life. It means that the person who goes there is usually prepared to offer his life or health. This is truly a great sacrifice. Whoever becomes involved in this sacrifice is exalted by the battlefield, and they attain a spiritual peak. But those who departed, due to martyrdom, mostly the youth, it was a different matter for them. The young men who entered the battlefield, their movement and their growth were such that a person like the late magnanimous Imam Khomeini, who had experienced many years of spiritual journeying and mysticism, envied them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.